That night the city burnt, and the mother church of the city burnt with her. And yet the tower and the spire still stand, soaring to the sky, and I feel that's an emblem of the eternal majesty and love of God.
Greetings. You are tuned into the Miserable Offenders podcast. Pull up a chair and join the conversation as we seek answers to life's big questions, drawing wisdom from the well of traditional Anglican theology. This is a production of the North American Anglican.
Well, greetings and welcome back to the Miserable Offenders podcast. As promised, we are promptly back in your podcast feed with new great content about Anglican stuff. And I'm one of your hosts, Jesse Nigro. I'm the editor-in-chief of the North American Anglican. That's northamanglican.com. And today I'm joined by both of my miserable offending co-hosts. We have Isaac Rayberg.
Hi, this is Isaac Rayberg. I'm the rector of All Saints Anglican Church in San Antonio, Texas, and the archdeacon for liturgy in the Anglican Diocese of All Nations of the ACNA.
Glad to have you as usual, Father. And we are also joined by Andrew Brazier.
Hey there. I'm the archdeacon in the jurisdiction of Armed Forces and the Chaplaincy and also serve as their chancellor. And glad to be here with y'all.
Awesome. And today we have a it's always a special topic, of course, but this one is very special. This is the topic of Lambeth conferences. Specifically, some of those old Lambeth conferences. And I think we're going to be discussing some resolutions in light of the way the Anglican Communion seems to be working today, and especially in light of certain recent actions and statements made by GAFCON. Andrew, why don't you take it away here?
Yeah, so I think we've briefly talked about the Lambeth conferences in the past in one of a previous episode, but if somebody's a new listener, you're not familiar, the Lambeth conferences started out as an idea actually by an American Episcopalian bishop. I think it was John Henry Hopkins back in the 1850s, wanted to have an international gathering of what we now call the Anglican Church. But at that point, it was really the Church of England, which was dispersed throughout all of her colonies across the whole world, including the independent Episcopal Church, which was independent by nature of the revolution that occurred less than 100 years before that. But a lot of cross-pollinization had been happening. Of course, we received our orders, our Episcopal succession from the Church of England. And the thought was, why not gather them together in one body to have a conference, to collaborate, to share, to fellowship, to pray together? And eventually this dream was realized when the Archbishop of Canterbury made an invitation to have a conference at Lambeth, hence it's called the Lambeth Conference. It's always met at Lambeth in 1867. And starting in 1867, these meetings, these conferences would happen roughly every 10 years, although every now and then it'd be like 11 years or 9 years, or there'd be an interruption, especially due to the World Wars, which would, you know, maybe set it off by like 15 years. But typically every 10 years, the Archbishop of Canterbury would invite all those provinces who are members of Anglican churches to gather together to pray, to collaborate, to fellowship, and to create resolutions. And of course, a resolution, for those who are familiar, aren't binding, but really states what is the mind of the conference. And yet these resolutions have been extremely important, especially in recent times, as the split within the Anglican Communion has occurred and continues due to the neglect by many bodies within the Anglican churches in terms of abiding by these resolutions. So a long story short, I started diving into the first Lambeth Conference and looking at these resolutions, curious to see what they held, what they worked over. Some of them are quite mundane resolutions, but others are quite interesting. And Archdeacon Isaac, anything that I left out there, anything else you'd like to add about the Lambeth conferences?
Pretty much just that it is now considered one of the instruments of communion, and just looking at the timing, I think the Lambeth Conference really kind of birthed the Anglican Communion, because most folks date the official Anglican Communion to 1867. And so I think I can't remember where I read this, but I read that there were some people that were hoping it would end up being a bit more kind of like how the Eastern Orthodox do conciliarity, where when you're in communion, you actually are accountable to each other in some way. But that's not what happened at all. and so hence the resolutions not having any legal effect, not necessarily being binding, but rather expressing the moral and spiritual authority, the mind of the communion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really interesting feature. I'm not sure it's a good one, but it seems like the sort of thing that could only have been decided on in a gentler age, when far more agreement took place about the essentials of Christianity, or frankly, just human life in general, and with like a sort of smattering of Victorian sensibility added on. Now looking back, I can't help but think, why not have resolutions with teeth? But I'm sure it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah, that's kind of my take too. And maybe had this happened before the Victorian era, maybe there would have been teeth. So I think we were in this period of time where it couldn't have, which is unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. It was so nice back then.
Sure we were. So Andrew, you said you've been looking into the oldest ones. Anything from that first Lambeth Conference in 1867 that really jumps out at you?
You know, like, I thought it was really interesting seeing, you know, the issues they were facing. There was a couple of them that dealt with international issues that I'm not familiar with, that I have to research to see what are they really commenting on, because the resolution is so broadly worded that it's assuming that, like, well, when this resolution goes out, we'll know what we're talking about. Maybe, for example, if we had a resolution talking about, you know, Ukraine and Russia and the war that's going on, but then you get 100 years down the road and it's like, what's the conflict that they're referencing? You'd have to go back, you know, and realize, oh, yeah, there was a war between Russia and Ukraine. That's what they're talking about. But the one that stuck out for me, and that we'll probably put in the show notes, was Resolution 8 of Conference 1867, Lambeth Conference 1867. And I'll read it and then comment on what struck me. Resolution says, quote, that in order to the binding of the churches of our colonial empire and the missionary churches beyond them in the closest union with their mother church, it is necessary they receive and maintain without authorization the standards of faith and doctrine is now in use in that church. That nevertheless, each province should have the right to make such adaptations and additions to the services of the church as its peculiar circumstances may require, provided that no change or addition be made inconsistent with the spirit and principles of the Book of Common Prayer, and that all such changes be liable to revision by any synod of the Anglican Communion in which the said province shall be represented. Now, I know that was a mouthful there, but I'll reread what kind of struck out to me. And it was really this commitment that, quote, it's necessary that they, and this is talking about the colonial churches of which would all be the Church of England and the missionary churches beyond them in closest union with the Mother Church, which would include at that time the Episcopal Church, maybe a couple others I'm not familiar with historically, but today would include so many churches that are independent but part of the Anglican Communion. So, quote, that they would receive and maintain without alteration the standards of faith and doctrine as now in use in that church, meaning the Mother Church. And that just really hit me, since it's due to the alteration of the standards of faith and doctrine not only from this time period, deviating from what was held then, but also by the Mother Church itself, that has led us to the current unpleasantness within the Anglican Communion that's really necessitated a split between those who are upholding that faith and those who are walking away from it. So I'll kick it back over to you, Jesse, and kind of gather your thoughts on hearing this resolution and really where it's laying a line in the sand so many years ago that that still stands to this day and is still being crossed to this day.
Sure. Well, my first sort of thought about upon hearing that and reading was that final little bit about, and if you get this wrong, we'll invite you to a committee where we change it for you. You know? I mean,
so a little bit more tea.
Sounds absolutely. That's what I was going to say. Like, it might be like a toddler set of teeth, but that's teeth, you know, that's more than I'm used to seeing or hearing about. So that's pretty cool. It's like, you know, just so you know, there's a way to do it wrong, and we've, you know, we have ways of making it right. My second thought, though, is that it's interesting to think about how much variety, perhaps, was already baked into this particular scenario. Anybody who's a fan of the 1928 Book of Common Prayer, American Book of Common Prayer, is going to be aware, or is probably aware, that it takes its Eucharistic canon from the Scottish Episcopal Church, which was a different tradition, which had deviated in, frankly, the earlier years after the Reformation from the English 1662 communion service. And it involves an epiclesis and people who are more Eastern Orthodox fans, you know, get really excited about that. It is what it is. But it's interesting to think that that is maybe just one example of an amount of acceptable variety that is presumably sort of baked into this earlier settlement, earlier for us in the 1860s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, that does show that even before there was an Anglican Communion, and, you know, when many of those colonial churches were still in the Church of England, we did have the Mother Church and some of her daughters. You know, the American Church is one of them, but even before that, the Scottish Episcopal Church and Scotland had been wavering between its established church being Presbyterian or Episcopal. Eventually, the established church is Presbyterian, but there's a nonconformist Episcopal group. Church of Ireland at some point is a separate church. Same with Wales. I don't remember the timeline on those, but pretty much the English-speaking world, eventually everybody gets separate one way or the other. And so our American changes to the Book of Common Prayer were probably more radical than those done in Scotland when taking the Book of Common Prayer as a whole. Mm-hmm. But even though there were some significant changes, the bishops, both the American bishops and the English bishops, all agreed that the substance in theology isn't any different, that these are acceptable local varieties for a various reason. And in fact, when looking at the proposed Scottish canon, which I'm not sure was ever used in Scotland, you know, that particular at that time, we actually, the American canon kind of tried to mix it both a little bit. So it softened some of the language of the Scottish epiclesis and kept the force of the consecration in the words of institution.
That's interesting. I've heard thoroughly reformed academics even argue that the 1662 has an implicit epiclesis. So, I mean, I do sometimes wonder if these differences are made more of than they ought to be. But
they are. They're exaggerated big time.
I think it's really interesting because there's been that debate. I've heard the same thing, Jesse. I'm not well read on that topic, but heard the same thing in terms of an implicit epiclesis in the 62. And I think it's interesting that, like, the sentence that I focused in on is, like, maintain those standards of faith. But the next sentence acknowledges that, quote, nevertheless, each province should have the right to make such adaptations and additions to the services of the church as its peculiar circumstances may require. But then it hedges it and kind of says, now, but provided, quote, no change or addition be made inconsistent with the spirit and principles of the Book of Common Prayer, and that all such changes be liable to revision by any synod of the Anglican Communion in which the said province shall be represented. Now, there never has been an actual international synod of the Anglican Communion where, like, a binding change can be made on other provinces of, hey, your Book of Common Prayer is actually out of line with the Book of Common Prayer. But we have seen, especially in the American context, and beyond the American context, I should say, that embedded in a lot of constitution and canons is that, okay, the source of authority, the prayer book is the 1662, and our adaptation is hopefully and with the intent of walking in step with the principles and the spirit of the Book of Common Prayer. Now, of course, people can debate and argue, and we do. We've done that before on the merits and how well local adaptations has been. But certainly, it's pointing that the buck stops with the principles, the spirit, the theology of the 1662. And we see that as well in the Jerusalem statement, the Jerusalem Declaration for GAFCON members. That, too, is upholding the 1662 as the prayer book.
Yeah, and I think we should dive into that GAFCON context and statement here, but real quick, and I know I've said this on the podcast before, but I think it bears repeating. We're fans of the late great Dr. Peter Toon, and he always sort of said that the 28 prayer book is great, but it's sort of a lens through which to get to the 62 as the standard. Mm-hmm. You know, as an Englishman working in America and head of the Prayer Book Society USA, mm-hmm. you know, and I never thought that was an insult to the 1928. And I've, you know, made the same sort of recommendation. And I think, Andrew, your article even giving ways to sort of make the 2019 ACNA Book of Common Prayer within canonical, you know, strictures, more agreeable or a better reflection of the 1662 Holy Communion service, sort of reflects that same mentality, which is to say, this is our way, you know, this is our stream to get to the river, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that has to be thought of as an insult to the local sort of stream, as it were. I know you get into dangerous territory talking about streams in an Anglican context, but I think you guys know what I mean.
You know, well, you know, the streams that I'm always in is that of the three formularies. So
your three streams, brother, are three formularies.
I appreciate the three formularies. So
that's amazing.
I'll leave it at that. But no, like, I think you're absolutely right, Jesse. And that article, you know, where I'm using the rubrics that are provided there to make a 1662 ordering, you know, I think it's a helpful way, like you said, using that lens language, to remember the one who brought you know, to go back to the 1662, to be able to see, especially there's so many new clergy in ACNA, so many new Anglicans, and they'll even look at the 2019, if that's what they're using, and they're like, what does this mean? You know, like, well, when should we do this? You know, it gives me an option here. You know, when should we decide when to use and when not to use? And I always encourage, buy a copy of the 1662, go back to it, look at its rubrics. Because in a lot of places in 2019, it's silent as to what our tradition is. but it gives you options. So I always say, go back and look at the 62 to give you a fuller sense, a fuller explanation, because those rubrics can be quite long in giving you details that you don't have in the 2019. But the 2019 will allow you to use them, because there's a lot of like, you may do this, you don't have to do that. Well, now you learn, well, when do I use this? Why do I use this? What's the theology and the reasoning behind it? So I think that lens language is really good, no matter where you're at. If you're in a North American context or somewhere else, whatever your local prayer book is, looking back to the 62 to understand the reasoning for it, the why behind it, and getting a fuller, deeper sense of our Anglican theology.
Yeah, I've gotten to a point absolutely. Where as much as, you know, with the 1662 International coming out, you know, I was like, oh my gosh, this is just the best thing since sliced bread. But you know, a year or so after, you know, you know, referring to it a lot, I kind of have come to the point where as an American, I want to use the American Prayer Book, as good as that International edition is, and with all due respect to some of my my friends who that's what they're using to good effect. But with the caveat that the 1662's theology is what is informing everything. So I will not, you know, you should not pit these two against each other, say, oh, because the 1662 doesn't have an epiclesis, it's not a real communion. Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, that's just liturgically foolish.
Right. Yeah, that is the kind of sort of theological anarchy that unfortunately the 20th century of American Anglicanism has made notorious, but we stand for something higher and greater than that. And certainly this Lambeth Resolution intended to maintain a real order of faith and liturgics. And in light of the recent Kigali statement, which we recorded a podcast about, and the formation of GAFCON, it seems that, as we said earlier, the lack of teeth sort of created a situation over the years where not everybody was doing their part to maintain this fidelity across the Anglican communion. Does that sound about right, Andrew?
Yeah, I think so. You know, that's one of those things that we can lament, and we get to armchair quarterback now, you know, some over 100 years since the Lambeth Conference. I think it was a noble effort. It was a great idea. And I hate that we couldn't create some sort of, you know, bonds, some sort of constitution that would help govern not only these future meetings, but govern the communion. And like you mentioned before, Jesse, I probably would have done it even if I put myself back in time, because I would have thought, we're all the same faith, you know, like, what could possibly go wrong, you know, and Lord have mercy, right. What hasn't gone wrong in the past, you know, just 50 years, much less 100 years. So I think they did what they thought was appropriate. And as we kind of dive further into these conferences, we'll see in the third conference in 1888, they even outline, you know, a way to have conversations and even reunion with other Christian groups and denominations. And I think that was really kind of the height of ambition, the height of an Orthodox ecumenical movement. But that moment soon passed. But hopefully, Lord willing, will be revived so that we will all truly be one, but one in the way, the truth, and the life.
And when we when we go further down on this 1867 one, we don't need to get into this, but resolutions 9 and 10 do seem to indicate that they were hoping to set up something with teeth, and it apparently just never really happened.
Very interesting. Yeah, I with the with a time machine, I think I would just go back and say, what you guys need, you can call on an instrument of communion. It'll be a verger who just smacks the local archbishop every time he wants to do something heretical, or even allow it to happen. You know, just when heresy is creeping, you have a verger who can just keep order on the local level. That's my suggestion. I don't know if the GAFCON primates are listening, but, you know,
You know, I did come aware or be made aware of there is a verger society in ACNA. And so I like the idea of making sure to equip our vergers with the proper, I forget what you call it. Is it just the verge that they have to whack people, you know? So yeah. You need to give those vergers training in the use of the verge. So
that's right. That's right.
The next MMA, verge combat.
Verge combat.
Absolutely. We are brilliant, or not. We'll let the audience decide. on that note, this Jerusalem Declaration sure feels like, 100 or so years later, the search for teeth in the Anglican Communion, does it not?
Yeah, I like that. Like Star Trek III, the search for Spock, but here we are. You know, this is the Trekkie enemy showing.
I like that.
You know, century three, you know, the search for discipline. So, but yes, I mean, I think we see that in terms of the Jerusalem Declaration and statement that accompanies it, really outlining, really regurgitating what had been said in a lot of Lambeth conferences earlier, but noting that, hey, doctrine matters, the faith matters.
Yeah.
And even linking up, we talked about the prayer book in statement six of, we rejoice in our Anglican sacramental and liturgical heritage as an expression of the gospel, and we uphold the 1662 Book of Common Prayer as a true and authoritative standard of worship and prayer to be translated and locally adapted for each culture. Really a great way of re-saying that latter part of Resolution 8 that we read earlier. And Jesse, as you noted, it's really looking towards, you know, having something more than a gathering over biscuits and tea, but also that has teeth. And of course, this is, you know, predating the most recent GAFCON meeting, because this was formulated at the first one. But it shows in statement 13, we reject the authority of those churches and leaders who have denied the Orthodox faith in word or deed. We pray for them and call on them to repent and return to the Lord. And so you see the beginnings of there needs to be discipline. It doesn't outline how it will be done. And quite frankly, GAFCON hasn't yet articulated how it would be done. It sounds like, as we discussed in a previous episode, that the Global South, through its covenant, will start to put meat on the bones of an ecclesial discipline structure within the Anglican Church. But until then, we have to continue to walk faithfully with those who are walking faithfully in the Orthodox faith, upholding the scriptures once delivered.
Yeah, it seems to me that the 20th century will be remembered as sort of a great move and shift towards secularity, to people sort of abandoning the old ways. Whether they lived in a Christian society or a sort of nominally Christian society. And my hope, as we've sort of been able to look back and kind of watch the slow disintegration of once great institutions, that the 21st century becomes remembered for sort of the reassertion of discipline, of godly, prudential leadership, and so on. Isaac, I didn't mean to catch you off there.
Yeah, I think that's a good hope. Yeah, I know that our African brothers and sisters often look at the 1990s as the time when they really, you know, the gospel went forward. There was real revival, and may we see the early decades of the 21st century do the same for the rest of us.
Amen. Well, is there anything else that we want to... This is, in a bit, a return to these Lambeth GAFCON-level conversations that we were having a few episodes ago. Any further thoughts along those lines? One theme was, hey, at the local level, don't let yourself get bogged down by these big picture things that are important, but not always the most important thing. But anything else on sort of this role of authority and documents with teeth and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think one thing that we need to do as clergymen, I hate to use the term influencers or thought leaders in the Anglican world. those things seem so Twitter. But one of the things we do need to do is reach back into our history and review these things. It's so easy for us to get just to have a really short memory and to be a little amnesiac. And if we can learn from these things, we can do better going ahead. I had a brief conversation with one of the members of our congregation who talked about the way that he was taught back in the 1970s regarding the Articles of Religion when he was a postulant for orders, and it was, let's just say, it was bad. You know, it was I was like, yeah, this is exactly that kind of thing is why we are where we are.
No doubt. Well, I think we're nearing the 30-minute mark here, and we've done it some justice. I think we should, as you say, Father, sort of return to some of these older documents and perhaps look at some other resolutions that, whoops, we let slip. and hopefully, you know, learn from the past and, you know, how can Christians safeguard God's truth going forward? So, amen. With all that said, thank you, dear listener, for joining us today, and we'll see you next time.
It was the spirit of our forefathers that built that grand building. I believe that that spirit is with us still and will help us to rebuild it one day when we've served and suffered a while, a little longer. Build it again to the glory of Jesus Christ.
Miserable Offenders is a production of the North American Anglican. Learn more at NORTHAM Anglican.com.